Hello and welcome to The Rest Is Money with me, Steph McGovern.
And with me, Robert Peston. And so what are we up to today?
We are taking listeners' questions. I mean, I love reading all the different variety of questions we get because some are like very personal to people and others are big macroeconomic theories they want us to talk about. But we're going to start with one from Alex, who says, they've just listened to the podcast we did with Paul Johnson on their way into work. They said, excellent as ever. Thanks very much for that, Alex. What Alex wants to know, though, is does the debt really matter? So the debt that we as a country get into. This is something I get asked a lot, actually, because people just say, why does it matter? Who do we owe the money to? Why don't we just print more money? So do you want to start us off, Robert? Does the debt really matter?
So I'm afraid to say, and not everybody agrees with me, but my view is, yes, the debt does really matter, but this idea that there is a straightforward number for the debt that a country can afford and then a higher number that the country can't afford, that's for the birds. Working out what the level of affordable debt is tricky. But I do want to explain why the debt matters. And there are a number of ways of analysing this. The most important one right now is just the amount of interest that we are paying on the government's debt. So 70, 80 billion pounds a year of interest on the national debt, which could be, if we weren't paying that interest, spent on improving our schools, spent on improving our hospitals, giving pay rises to teachers or people working in the health service. It's a lot of money. That is, you know, if you're looking at 70, 80 billion pounds of interest being spent, you know, that's more than we spend in England on schools. That's about 60 billion a year. I mean, it's sort of four times the police budget. So this is meaningful money that if we weren't paying it to investors who own the bonds, could be directed to improving our public services. So that's one reason it matters. But for me, the big reason it matters that the national debt has been rising in a very significant way, and just to remind people, since, let's say, 2010, the national debt in real terms, that's as a share of national income, has more than trebled. So the amount that we've been borrowing every year has been swelling that debt year after year. So it's now equivalent to about the value of the economy. It's about 100% of national income, right? The reason it matters, and it matters to us, it matters to Europe, it matters to America, is everybody would have noticed that interest rates have been going up. And, you know, bank rate is 5.25%, the sort of benchmark for interest rates in the economy. Now, there's something called the sort of natural rate of interest for a government when they're paying the interest on their debt. What we mean by that is that taking out the cycle of interest rates, the ups and the downs, if there's a sort of slightly fundamental rate of interest rate that a government has to pay, if that is above the growth rate in the economy, then the amount you pay in interest will progressively, inexorably swell the national debt. This is one of the reasons why it's not just the debt that matters, and it's not just the interest rate that matters, it's the growth rate of the economy that matters. And if you are a low growth economy, but the fundamental interest rate, the sort of natural rate of interest that investors are going to charge the government for lending to the government is above that growth rate, then you are in trouble. You're in a debt trap, right? Because basically your debt can be seen by the whole world to be rising every year, and absent massively slashing public services or massively raising taxes to get your debt down, you're in trouble, right? And investors can see you're in trouble. And at that point, they actually make it more expensive for you to borrow. And the important comparison, therefore, is between Europe with large levels of debt and America with very large levels of debt. Actually, the debt in America is currently, compared to much of Europe, rather bigger than it is here. But the reason why arguably the problem is not as serious for America as it is here is because the growth rate of the American economy is way faster. Okay, so they are generating tax revenues that can service the debt in a way that is harder for Europe. That is why there are all these people who believe in theories like modern monetary theory, and just the Bank of England can just create all this money and you can wipe out the debt, or you can just write off the debt and, you know, government can just say, we're not going to pay you back. At that point, you know, there's a real risk that investors are just going to go on strike and not going to want to lend to you at all. And then you're in real trouble. So I'm afraid to say the debt does matter.
Yeah. And isn't it also just simple debt maths, in the sense of if it gets more expensive to borrow money, it's going to be more expensive to make repayments. And if you can't afford the repayments, then inevitably, you know, someone like the IMF is going to have to come in and try and help you, like they did with Greece. And then when they did that, they had to bring in all this severe austerity measures as part of the package that they got to be bailed out. So none of it ends well if you don't take debt seriously, does it?
No, I mean, you have to take debt seriously. That is totally right.
Should we move on to another question then? There's one from Simon, isn't there, on capital gains tax. We've talked loads about capital gains tax because it's a big thing in the election and mentioned in manifestos. Some of them it's not mentioned in, and people are wondering whether parties are going to bring in an increase in capital gains tax. But do you want to just tell us what the question is from Simon, Elmer?
Yeah. So Simon's asked us a great question. He was struck by the conversation we had on a wealth tax, and he was asking if there was capital gains tax on all residential property. So he must mean including your primary residence, your primary home. Then he says he would envisage that this could be used to fund affordable housing, releasing the current subsidies for use elsewhere. And there could be a tax break in respect of homeowners investing in bringing their home up to decent environmental standards. So what do you think about that proposal?
Yeah. Well, it's worth just reminding everyone about capital gains tax on residential properties, because as you've just said, as things stand, you don't pay capital gains tax when you sell your main residence, unless it's partly being used for business or you lease some of it out. But on the whole, capital gains tax isn't paid on your main residence. It is, however, paid on any profit you make when you sell a second home or a buy-to-let property. Now, so this idea of it being on all residential properties is a really interesting one, because I saw an estimate saying that if it was on all properties, it could bring in £30 billion a year. However, there is lots of problems with this. First of all, it really wouldn't be fair on people who have to move around for their jobs, would it? And it would stop people wanting to sell their homes. It would stop people downsizing. It would clog up the property market. People wouldn't want to pay this tax on their main residence. And also at the other end of the scale, you know, you'd have people who are the wealthier property owners who we've talked about in the past, the older property owners who probably need to downsize to free things up for us, then wouldn't want to, because they wouldn't want to pay this tax. So it could actually really stop things moving in the housing market, couldn't it? If people suddenly had to pay capital gains tax on any property that was sold, even though it could bring in lots of money for the government, it's totally impractical and would cause big, you know, wouldn't help the housing market and wouldn't help first time buyers, for example, because then it would push up prices, wouldn't it? But it wouldn't work, I don't think. Do you?
So one of the things we've talked about on the programme is the fact that if you look at all those people whose children have moved out and are sitting in houses with multiple bedrooms, which they don't use, you could solve a big chunk of the housing crisis if you persuaded those people to downsize. And remember, one of my ideas, which we talked about in a previous programme, is why don't you have a regime where, if you're downsizing, if you're selling, let's say, a five-bedroom house as a retired couple and you're moving into a two-bedroom flat, wouldn't it be a good idea to give those people a tax break, waive the stamp duty on the flat they're buying, as an incentive to them to free up their original property, which could then be occupied by a family with kids, right? So plainly, as I say, if you could simply reallocate the ownership of property so that all these empty bedrooms get filled, that would be a big help. So I was talking to somebody quite close to the Labour leadership. This is not a Labour proposal. It was something that's obviously been knocked around a bit in those circles, which is, what about a bedroom tax, right? So we've talked a lot about wealth taxes. So if you were going to reform, let's say, council tax, which is, in a way, council tax is just a very, very bad wealth tax because you know, it hasn't been, the revaluations haven't been for donkey's years, and it's very inefficient tax. But if you were going to revisit council tax, what do you think about the idea that you should be taxed more for, if you've got a load of bedrooms that you're not using?
I guess the tricky thing would be how you justify if you're using them or not, because you could quite easily say, you know, my children come back and stay quite regularly. Like, how would you define whether they're used or not? You might be someone who's elderly and say, well, I have friends visit every weekend, so I am using them. So I think it would be really tricky to police it. But I do think it's a good idea because, you know, we should be encouraging people to downsize. Unless they really don't want to, but if there was a financial incentive to downsize, then that could make a big difference, couldn't it?
I mean, look, even if Labour Party succeeds with its proposal to build 1.5 million houses by the end of the next parliament, actually the Tories are promising 1.6 million. They've never hit any of their housing targets in recent years. And let's say Labour succeeds in reforming the planning system and driving through these housing developments, building new towns as they promised. Let's just say they do all of this. Even that 1.5 million is not going to meet the massive demand there is for housing. So we do have to think radically about how we use the existing housing stock better.
But do you remember, Robert, when there was the introduction of the bedroom tax back in 2013? So the coalition brought this in with the idea being that any benefits paid to tenants would be cut if they had a spare bedroom or one or more spare bedrooms. So I think it was something like it would be cut by 14% if they had one spare bedroom, or by 25% if they have two or more. And the idea of this was to try and encourage people who had too many bedrooms to downsize and move to other properties, and then hopefully cut down the welfare bill and free up the kind of demand in housing. But what it actually did was end up putting a load of people in rent arrears, particularly disabled people. It hit single parents. It was a, you know, it was a bit of a disaster in the end, this whole bedroom tax, because although it seemed on one sense obvious to, you know, try and recoup a bit of money, in practical terms, it didn't work. And it actually ended up being a really negative policy.
So that seems an appropriate moment to go off and have a quick break. So welcome back to The Rest Is Money with me, Robert Peston.
And me, Steph McGovern. We are answering your questions. So I'm going to go straight into another one. This is about the EU-UK trade deals. Theo's asking, how is it actually possible for Rachel Reeves to improve UK-EU trade deals if Labour are unwilling to rejoin the customs union or single market?
So the honest answer is they can't improve it very much. I mean, they're talking about reaching agreement with the EU to, you know, on things like, you know, veterinary issues. But fundamentally, the kind of things they're talking about is pretty much tinkering around the edges. You know, things like having slightly more convergence when it comes to recognising professional qualifications, making it easier for performers to tour, that kind of things. I mean, all these things are useful, but in terms of our trade performance, they are pretty trivial. So the big issue for me is this. We do have at the moment with the EU absolutely clear, common political interest, military interest, security interest in challenging Putin, in making it clear that we're a united front and we've got the kind of military resources that he can't ignore. We went into this conflict with Putin over his invasion with Ukraine with our military is all desperately cut back and completely dependent both on American money for Ukraine and American-made arms. One of the things that Europe needs to be doing is gearing up its arms manufacturing. One of the things that all European countries need to be doing is increasing their defence spending, building up the size of their military. It seems an amazing thing for me to be saying this, given that for so many years, I was one of those people who took the view that the collapse of the Soviet Union meant that it was safe to cut defence spending. But the world is now, frankly, a much more dangerous place, not just Putin. Plainly, if you look further east and you look at China's ambitions when it comes to taking control of Taiwan, there's an issue there. You only got to look at the Middle East and look at the conflagration there to realise that we've got to see more investment both in military manufacturing within the EU, which is very interesting. Defence companies booming at the moment as a result of all this. And we've also got to build up, as I say, military capability throughout Europe. Now, the UK has both a defence sector, but equally a military that is more significant than any other European countries apart from France. And at a time when actually the commitment of the US to seeing off Putin, if Trump is elected, you know, we cannot take America's support for granted. So this is a moment where any new prime minister has to say to the EU, we've got to stand together. Now, my own view would be, this is something that most European governments acknowledge, and it gives us a way in to broader conversations about trade, because this is a rare moment where we've actually got something that the rest of Europe needs. Up to now, the story of Brexit has been the story of Brussels and European governments punishing the UK because they did not want the UK to leave the EU. So they had this massive incentive in proving that leaving the EU was a terrible mistake. They wanted to make it as bad for us as they possibly could. We now have something to offer them, something really important to offer them. And if I were the new Prime Minister, I would lead on defence cooperation with the rest of the EU, but use that as a way to rebuild negotiations to get a better trade deal that may not be the customs union or the single market. And the problem for any prime minister at the moment in going back into the customs union or the single market is it places obligations on the UK. If it's the single market, free movement of people to the UK, which no prime minister wants to sign up to. In the case of the customs union, it limits our ability to do trade deals with other countries, which again, no prime minister wants to, you know. So for a period at least, rejoining the customs union and the single market is difficult for Keir Starmer. Not impossible in a matter of years, but I do think for the first time since we left the EU, we have bargaining power with the EU, which we should use in the foreign policy defence sphere, but use it to also get a better deal in the commercial sphere.
It's just a reminder of how rubbish it was that we ever left the EU in the first place, though, isn't it? There just seems to be no positives at all from any of this. It's just left us weaker in every sense.
Well, I'm sure we'll be coming back actually to talk about this, because one of the things that, you know, there's no question in my mind, the Brexit debate is not over, right? Whether politicians like it or not, they don't want to talk about it in this general election, but it is not over. The majority of British people now say it was a mistake to leave the EU, quite a significant majority. So this issue is not going away.
Yeah. Let's move on to another question now. We've got one from Sean talking about public services. Obviously, this is something we've covered a lot in our episodes recently, particularly looking at how the manifesto's plan to solve the problems with public services. Sean Finlay says, in your opinion, how much do we need to increase the tax burden by to get functioning public services? Now, I guess part of the answer to this, Sean, is that it shouldn't be just about taxes, should it? And I guess this is Labour's point that we're going to get more growth, and growth is what's going to bring in more money to help pay for public services. But we also, I guess, need to think more creatively about how we use and pay for public services in the future, because it is at breaking point. We do have this massive black hole. We can't afford to carry on the way we're going. And it can't just be a case of ramping up taxes to a ridiculous level. But Robert, I mean, what do you think on this?
So one of the things we pointed out on a number of occasions is that the tax burden in the UK is lower than it is in many other European countries where public services are better than they are here. We may have to increase the tax burden a bit to improve the quality of our public services. But it isn't just about tax. It is also about the organisation of public services. It's about the productivity of people working in the public services. There is a fair amount of data that in a number of public services, productivity, as it has in the whole economy, has been flatlining in recent years. I'm obsessed with artificial intelligence, as you know. I am absolutely clear that deployed in the right way, artificial intelligence will improve productivity, will give us more bang for our buck. And then there's the other issue that it's not just about day-to-day spending. It is not just about, for example, more doctors, more nurses, more people in other jobs within the NHS, for example. It is also about the quality of the buildings. It is about the quality of the kit they have. We need to invest more. If we had frankly, more sensible fiscal rules. We wouldn't have to raise taxes to invest in the NHS. We could borrow to invest in the NHS, and actually investors would tolerate borrowing to invest in the NHS or in transport or in schools. Why? Because they know that all of this investment improves the growth rate of the economy. Even investing in a hospital improves the growth rate of the economy, because if a hospital can treat people who are unwell faster, those people will be back at work faster, and businesses will benefit from that. They will be earning money. So investment across the piece is good for our prosperity, and we ought to design fiscal rules that encourage a bit more investment than the Tory government's fiscal rules. But I would argue, even so, the fiscal rules that the Labour Party has, which is getting the overall debt down in 5 years, puts too much of a ceiling right now on how much we can invest. And they have got to be more creative and more imaginative about all of that.
Do you know what I think as well? We hear so much on the show, when, particularly when we interview entrepreneurs and business leaders, about how AI has been used in business. And you've just mentioned AI there. Wouldn't it be great if, rather than necessarily a financial tax, what if there was like some type of obligation to collaborate with, you know, AI learning? For example, we've interviewed Greg Jackson, the founder of Octopus, and he talked to us about the great way they're using generative AI to help with their customer service, and it's massively improved productivity gains. And they've got this whole customer service platform called Kraken, which they've now licensed to lots of other energy companies, even though they're rivals. Wouldn't it be great if there was like an obligation where we're not going to make you pay shed loads of tax, but why don't you give us that software? Or could that be used in the NHS somehow? And I know obviously there's issues around then about the value of it and it being copied and blah, blah, but if you have to pay big money in tax anyway, wouldn't this be a great way of just trying to actually learn from the private sector and there be some type of cross-business, cross-organisation productivity benefits by the private sector having to do more for the public sector? Sounds a bit radical, but...
Well, I certainly think if we could get to a world where more private sector institutions felt that they wanted to give their expertise for free to the public sector.
In teaching, but could you imagine if companies made their workers, you know, go in and do some of the lessons, like there would be, you know, and then they cut their tax bill by a couple of percent. That could really help reduce the teacher bill and really help to, I just think we need to think more radically rather than just it's about how much we pay for things. It isn't just about that. It's like how we share learning and how we, you know, that would make such common sense. If there was people from companies doing lessons in schools, then there would be direct learning of what employers need, as well as kids getting real genuine expertise. I'm not trying to do all the brilliant teachers out of a job, but I just think things could go hand in hand a lot more. And I know I live in this utopia that probably would never exist, but it would be great if we just thought about things differently rather than public versus private and business bad, public sector, the poor people left behind. It just feels like there could be so much more collaboration there that wasn't all profit-based. But there we go.
So I think you're right. I think, you know, sometimes people are too cynical about human nature. But in the end, I think I do slightly disagree with you. I think the fundamental failure often of the public sector is it just is not commercial enough. So it gets ripped off, it gets really bad contracts. You know, yeah. What I'd like to see is just a lot more commercial expertise within the public sector. When it comes to the health service, for example, you know, the health service has the most amazing stock of incredibly valuable data about us, about our conditions. They should absolutely ring fence that and exploit it in a commercial way for our benefit, not for some foreign multinational's benefit. You own it and then you make sure that you get the reward when you're researching it and deploying it for all sorts, whether it might be drug discovery, whether it might be, you know, learning about basically patterns of organization, you make sure that you rapaciously earn that money for the British public sector, for the British taxpayer.
But it would work though, that, because I don't think you're saying a point that's against mine. I don't see why we can't have something which, I guess, you know, Rishi Sunak talked about a national service, and it kind of is like an extension of that, even though I don't necessarily agree with exactly how Rishi sold that. But what if there was a kind of like, I don't know, like a business national service where companies had to provide for free, companies that could afford it, obviously, to send in like their top managers or their top procurement people or their top HR people into public sector organizations for a stint for free, where they could be, you know, they could learn from it, they could learn how to increase their productivity, how to deal with staff issues, procurement, whatever it is, and learn all that and get that knowledge for free from business with some type of tax incentive for the business. So it's not just them always having to hand over loads of money to the government in taxes. They're actually helping the whole of society by sharing the wealth of their knowledge from business in the private sector into the public sector. So that's my point. I just think we think too black and white about private versus public, and there should be more collaboration that isn't about money, but instead is about knowledge and technology and experience. And I think that could make a huge difference to how the public sector does.
Look, I'd love for us to get into your partnership world. I think the problem that I've basically got at the moment is pretty much all the big intellectual property in this AI space is owned by these enormous American giants, even though a lot of the expertise that created this amazing know-how for these enormous American giants was originally British research, which then got exploited by American companies. Mm. So there's an enormous amount we need to do to keep this stuff onshore. But right now, given that the owners of so much of this fundamental AI technology are foreign, what we need to do is make sure we don't just become essentially subsidiaries of these giants, that we take control of our destiny. And I've said this a million times, and maybe we should do another program about this at some point. The big, big failure of this general election by a million miles is nobody is talking about how to make this AI industrial revolution work for British people,
yeah,
so that British people become richer rather than poorer. And, you know, we've got to redesign our welfare system, we've got to redesign our school system. And the opportunities are immense, but also the potential downside of people just being made poorer by all of this is also immense. It's a big conversation. Let's have it another time.
Yeah. You sound deflated. Right. Okay. Let's wrap things up. Thank you very much for all the questions. Just a reminder, you can send them to restismoney@gmail.com, or you can send them through our social media pages. But that's it from us for now. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.